Well, welcome, all of you, to the first presentation of our hospitality seminar. There's more to look forward to tomorrow. At 9:30, Ben Kai will speak on image bearers of a hospitable God. Sarah Chestnut will lead a workshop on table talk, or making conversation, at 11:15. Joe Morrell will serve lunch, and we'd appreciate it if you let us know, if you haven't already, if you plan to be here for lunch. At 1:30, Mary Frances Giles will give the talk, "But I Can't Cook, Practical Hospitality for Everyone." And our final event will be a roundtable discussion at 3:15, moderated by Sue Morrell. I hope many of you will be able to join us for tomorrow. As most of you probably realize, LaBrie Fellowship is a ministry of hospitality. So you might say that practicing hospitality is our full-time job. But Scripture makes it very clear that hospitality is the responsibility of all God's people. The ancient Near East was a desert culture where dehydration could happen quickly. Hospitality, taking in a stranger and providing food and drink, could be a matter of life and death. It's not surprising that many desert cultures today continue to value hospitality as one of the most important virtues. But we don't live in a desert culture, and many of the activities that used to make the home the center of life have been removed from the home. In fact, many homes sit empty all day long while children are in school and adults are out breadwinning. And many families spend weekends running from one sports event or other activity to another. So how are Christians meant to practice hospitality today? This is a topic that we will discuss in a lot more detail tomorrow, the practicalities of it. Tonight I want to consider the Bible's teaching about hospitality and also the Christian tradition of hospitality, particularly its origin in the early church period. I'll also reference Christians who reflected on, preached about, and practiced hospitality at other times in Christian history. As we struggle to understand the responsibility of Christian hospitality in our cultural setting, it's helpful to realize that Christians in earlier centuries struggled with many of the same questions that we do. Who do we welcome into our homes, churches, and communities? Isn't it risky to welcome strangers? Are some needy people deserving of generosity and welcome, and others undeserving? Is it even legitimate to make that distinction? What if people take advantage of you? What if they damage your property? What kinds of limits and boundaries are legitimate? Is there a difference between entertaining and hospitality? In thinking about these questions, I'll be bouncing back and forth between our experience and Dick and my experience, but also experience of others in LaBrie, and the experience of Christians in earlier historical periods. I'll be drawing from Christine Pohl's book, Making Room, Recovering Hospitality as a Christian Tradition. Dick and I met Christine back in the 1970s, soon after her return from English LaBrie. In researching for this book, which was also her PhD thesis, she visited a number of other intentional hospitality ministries. And I very much appreciate her use of church history to inspire contemporary Christians to take seriously the biblical admonitions to practice hospitality today. She's written a second book, Living into Community, is that what it's called? Living into Community, which I have not read yet, but I'm sure it's great based on her first one. You should have an outline, kind of a general outline, basically a list of topics with a few comments underneath. I'll just read through quickly the topics I'm going to talk about, the meaning of hospitality, obstacles to hospitality, costs and risks, blessings of hospitality, sharing meals, the mark of the Christian, actually with the title of a little book written by Francis Schaeffer, Christian and Hellenistic hospitality contrasted, some practical ideas, and some limits and boundaries. So first of all, the meaning of hospitality. I think it's fair to say that the word hospitality has lost a moral dimension that used to be central to its meaning. Henry Nouwen observed, the word hospitality conjures up images of tea parties, bland conversation, and a general atmosphere of coziness. Close quote. Nouwen spent the last years of his life as pastor of the L'Arche Daybreak Community in Toronto, a ministry of hospitality to people with severe disabilities. there's, of course, the hospitality industry. There's plenty of seats up here. Feel free to come up. The hospitality industry. In hotels and restaurants, strangers are very welcome as long as they have a credit card. The hospitality committee of a large church often does no more than shake hands with people as they come in, hand out welcome cards for strangers, and organize a coffee hour. The Greek word for hospitality is philoxenia. It combines the general word for love or affection for people who are connected by kinship or faith, phileo, and the word for stranger, xenos. So hospitality literally means love of strangers or loving the stranger. It's the love of brother or sister extended to strangers, philoxenia. While the New Testament mentions a special gift of hospitality, both the Old and New Testaments command all of God's people to be hospitable, to love the stranger, and to welcome strangers into our lives and homes. Paul instructs believers to pursue hospitality. The writer of Hebrews says, "Do not neglect hospitality." Peter writes, "Offer hospitality ungrudgingly." And one of the mandatory requirements for church leadership is that the elder or bishop be given to hospitality. Why is hospitality so important? Because of God's character and because of our shared humanity and solidarity with all people. I think Ben will be talking more about this tomorrow morning. Scripture says over and over again, God welcomed us when we were strangers, when we were even enemies. Therefore, we must welcome the stranger with whom we share the same flesh and blood. In the Old Testament, we read, God defends the cause of the fatherless and the widow and loves the alien, the stranger, giving him food and clothing. And you are to love those who are aliens, for you yourselves were aliens in Egypt. Fear the Lord your God and serve him. Similarly, in the New Testament, Paul reminded the Gentile believers that they were no longer strangers and aliens, having no hope and without God in the world. Together with Jewish believers, they were now citizens with the saints and welcomed members of the household of God. Use of the word citizen is significant. In the Roman Empire, you had to be a citizen to have rights. Slaves were by definition excluded from citizenship and therefore all rights. Yet in the church, all believers, including slaves and second-class citizens like women, the poor, and aliens, had equal rights as citizens in God's household or community. The Apostle Peter reminded Christians of their present status as aliens and strangers in the world. Christians are therefore aliens who practice hospitality to strangers in grateful response to God's hospitality to them. Paul describes strangers as, quote, those who are disconnected from basic relationships that give persons a secure place in the world. The most vulnerable strangers are detached or excluded from family, community, church, work, and polity. Scripture repeatedly commands hospitality to aliens, refugees, widows or single mothers, the fatherless, the poor, vulnerable, and those who cannot reciprocate. Strangers may be different from us in terms of geography, race, age, culture, education, socioeconomic status, religion, and morals. But as Charles Dickens wrote in A Christmas Carol, all men and women are fellow travelers to the grave, not another race of creatures bound on other journeys. I love that quote. Hospitality means welcoming people into a safe, personal, and comfortable place. It includes not only caring for their physical needs, food, shelter, and protection, but offering respect, friendship, and acceptance, a place in our family or community. I want to speak a little bit now about early Christian practice. In the early centuries of the church, Christians welcomed traveling missionaries and leaders, local poor, pilgrims, religious exiles, and refugees from war and famine. The Christians were some of the first to welcome exposed infants, newborns, who were abandoned in a public place either to die or to be picked up. Exposure was the most common form of family planning in the ancient world. surviving infants automatically bore the stigma and deprivations of slave status. Many of them made money for their owners by begging, prostitution, or becoming gladiators. In contrast, the Christians adopted exposed infants and raised them as their own children, remembering that Jesus was abandoned in our place so that we might be welcomed into God's family. In fact, every Christian is by definition an adopted child by God. James writes, "Religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this, to care for orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself unstained by the world." The word orphan includes exposed infants. I want to think now about obstacles to practicing hospitality, both today, but some of these were true in the past as well. First obstacle, this is very true for today, or for many people, nobody's home. Over the last 100 years or so, the home has dramatically changed from being the center of life, of family, of education, of work, job training, and the economy, of local community, and the place where vulnerable people were cared for. The sick, the mentally ill and disabled, and sometimes even criminals were placed in homes to be reformed. Now many homes function more like a bed and breakfast, where people sleep and eat breakfast, but aren't there much of the rest of the time. In the early Christian era, when churches met in homes, the home was also the place of intersection between the family and the church. One of the results of the split between home and its many past functions has been the privatization and idealization of the home. In Christopher Lash's words, home became a, quote, haven in a heartless world, unquote. At least as an ideal, although in reality, the now isolated, privatized home can often become the setting for violence and abuse. Nevertheless, many people regard the home as my castle, where I go to get away from stress. I only invite people I like into my home and only when I feel like it. This new view of the home is probably the reason why many of our Southborough neighbors and acquaintances are more uncomfortable with the fact that we welcome strangers into our home than by our religious commitment. They can make more sense of that, the fact of us being a Christian something, than the fact that we welcome people we don't know into our homes. Ironically, as families have gotten smaller, average homes have gotten bigger and bigger while serving fewer and fewer human needs. At the same time, the juvenile crime rate rises, the welfare rolls are swelling, the number of homeless people and children in state custody increases, and many unmarried pregnant girls have to choose between abortion and rejection by parents or boyfriends. So that's the first obstacle, nobody's home. Second obstacle is the belief that caring for needy people is the job of the government and other social welfare institutions. Chuck Colson tells this moving story, a moving example. He writes, "A young Delaware man from a broken home got into trouble and was sent to a state penitentiary. He was a model prisoner and got out 6 months early. But with no family, no job, and no one to help him, he was soon back on drugs and took other kids with him back into trouble. The people from his town were furious and wanted him to be locked up forever. The constituents' reaction illustrates how completely they've been taken in by the widespread notion that every problem must have a government solution. This dangerous illusion not only inflates government power, but it lulls people into feeling they're helpless, even about things in their own backyard." He goes on, "Just look at the absurdity the illusion created. Here are small town folk who for years watched a young lad grow up without parents, predictably headed for trouble. Then they became enraged when the state penitentiary, where kids are embittered and often brutalized, cannot cure the result of 20 years of community neglect." Close quote. The Carnegie Council on Adolescent Development found that adolescents from troubled backgrounds who develop into stable young adults do so almost invariably because one caring adult figure was a constant in the kid's life. The government cannot do this, nor can any impersonal institution. Many years ago, we had a student here in Southborough who had been a drug dealer. One teacher befriended him, and he never forgot that man. Our student decided to become a teacher so, in his words, "I can help kids like me." Jesus said, whoever welcomes a little child like this in my name welcomes me. But if anyone causes one of these little ones to stumble, it would be better for him to have a large millstone hung around his neck and be drowned in the depths of the sea. By ignoring or neglecting the fatherless children in our neighborhoods, extended families, schools, and churches, we share the responsibility for their stumbling. Many years ago, a woman in her 30s knocked on my parents' door. She said, I've come to thank you for saving my life. They didn't recognize her at first and were dumbfounded when she identified herself. As a neighbor child, a few years older than me, she had virtually lived with our family. She would just show up, and my parents always welcomed her, whatever was going on. She was in many of our family photos. She was just there. She used to love, my dad was an airline pilot, and one of her favorite things was my parents had a Jeep, and they took all the seats out, only one car, so my mom had to go pick up my dad when he'd come back from a flight. And she just put a mattress in the back of the car and just throw the four kids and Carol into the back of the car. And that was one of her most fond memories, just driving to the airport in the back of the Jeep with the four Drew kids and to pick up my dad. So this was the woman who came back to thank my parents. Her father was an alcoholic and her mother couldn't cope. She told my parents that it was watching them and experiencing their love and hospitality that gave her a positive vision and hope for her own life. She is now happily married with two grown sons. She's a grandma like me. To my amazement, this same woman recognized me as her childhood neighbor at Dick's 25th college reunion. This was years after I'd seen her. She tracked me down and told me the same story. Since her husband and Dick were in the same class at the same university, we see each other at every reunion. And ironically, both men also wrote books on heroism. They got together to talk about that. Well, there's no way the government could have given that little girl the love and vision that shaped her into the caring and productive woman she has become. The temptation to let larger impersonal institutions care for the needy is not a new one. In the early centuries of the church, Christian commitment to hospitality and care for the needy gave rise to the first hospitals for strangers, for the poor and for the sick. The Romans only put up soldiers who they knew were well enough to recover to be able to fight in the next war in hospitals. They were the only ones worth trying to heal. But Christians were the first to start hospitals for the poor and for anyone, not just for soldiers who could recover. Christians also started the first hostels for strangers and monasteries to welcome pilgrims. By the 4th century, with support from the Emperor Constantine, substantial public resources were allocated to the church, and hospitality came to be viewed as a public service. Christian hospitals and other institutions of care were recognized as exemplary in the ancient world. The growth of these kind of institutions was a necessary response to the growing scale of need, severe famines, and swelling numbers of urban poor, and so on. But inevitably, institutional care is more anonymous and less personal than hospitality in homes. It seems that some Christians excuse themselves from the responsibilities of opening their homes, since the church, aided by the state, had the means to do it. John Chrysostom, writing in the 4th and early 5th centuries, insisted that his parishioners continue to practice hands-on personal hospitality as well. He urged them to make a guest room in their homes, a place set apart for Christ, where they could welcome, quote, the maimed, the beggars, and the homeless. He argued that the welcome, compassion, and equal treatment intrinsic to personal hospitality was an essential part of Christian identity. Though he was one of the ones to develop specialized institutions of care, he didn't want Christians to rely exclusively on them and neglect their responsibility to care for people in the personal context of face-to-face hospitality. Okay, the third obstacle I'll mention is everybody's too busy. A common refrain is, I'm already shortchanging my immediate and extended family, my church, my neighborhood, not to mention myself. And there's a lot of literature out about how we're meant to take care of ourselves. Where will I find time to care for strangers? Given today's economy, many people simply have to work long hours in order to survive. this may be particularly true, or certainly true, for single parents, most of whom are mothers. On the other hand, there are many others who have the financial means to slow down, to work fewer hours, to allow one spouse to quit work altogether, or both to work part-time. Making changes like these could provide the time and presence necessary for hospitality. And it's good periodically for all of us to take stock of our priorities and consider whether God is calling us to make lifestyle changes, even radical ones. These are not easy issues, and I look forward to discussion both tonight and tomorrow on some of these things. The fourth obstacle I'll mention is having the wrong model. Entertaining, or impressing, rather than hospitality, which is serving. Over the years, a number of women have told me that the main obstacle they felt to practicing hospitality was that their homes weren't perfect enough. One woman said that with small children, she found it impossible to keep her house tidy. Yet she had a friend who also had small children, and her house just looked like it came straight out of House Beautiful. The woman who spoke to me found it so intimidating, she never dared invite people into her home. Well, what's going on here? I would suggest that this woman was confusing entertaining with hospitality. Entertaining is about impressing, whereas hospitality is about welcoming. It apparently hadn't occurred to her that if she felt so intimidated walking into a perfect home, then other people might feel uncomfortable in her home if it was too perfect. In fact, guests are more likely to feel welcome and comfortable in a lived-in looking home as long as the host is comfortable and doesn't apologize for it. One way of finding out whether you're motivated toward entertaining or hospitality is to ask yourself how you react when someone shows up at your door unexpectedly, especially around mealtime. Many years ago, a family of seven and another time a family of six showed up here with no warning, just as we were sitting down to dinner. I won't pretend that I was thrilled to see them. But thinking about it, I realized that in the ancient world, when there were no cell phones and you couldn't text people ahead of time, and people traveled by foot, most people probably would show up unannounced. And it's good to be prepared with food that can be stretched. You know, a can of spaghetti sauce and some pasta, which is pretty quick to put together. My dad spent his working life as a pilot for Pan American Airlines. He spent one Christmas day stuck in Portugal where he didn't know anyone. He walked the streets on a drizzly day feeling very lonely and very homesick. And I can assure you, he would much rather have spent the day with a noisy, chaotic Portuguese family in a messy house, eating unfamiliar food and struggling with the language, than alone in a restaurant. From that time, that was a wake-up call for our family. So from that time on, every Christmas morning, my mother would call up the foreign airlines that in New York City at Kennedy Airport. In those days, I think it was called Idlewild Airport. But she'd call up and find out if there were any stranded crew members stuck in New York for Christmas Day and invite them to come out to join our noisy, chaotic family. We had people every Christmas from British Airways, from Air France, from SAS, all different airlines. And it was fabulous. We would sit around the telephone and hope that there was someone stuck in New York who could join our family rather than being with our own family where they'd rather be. But they were invariably incredibly grateful and they made our day. We added a huge dimension to our family Christmases that we loved, and some of them became lifelong friends. Imagine yourself a stranger in an alien place. This is what it means to love your neighbor as yourself. Imaginatively put yourself in the shoes of your neighbor. Wouldn't you rather be welcomed into a lived-in looking home and share a sandwich or even a bowl of Campbell's soup than eat by yourself in a restaurant? Okay, the fifth obstacle to hospitality is having the wrong attitudes: pride, provincialism, snobbery, and fear. Xenophobia, which means fear and hatred of strangers, comes much more naturally to fallen people than philoxenia, love of strangers. A young Indian man who had recently converted from Islam to Christianity stayed at South Burberry for a while, many years ago. He told us that since his conversion, he had experienced prejudice and rejection from every church he attended. that no church extended Christian hospitality to him is really scandalous. In Romans 12, Paul wrote, "Do not think of yourselves more highly than you ought. Honor one another above yourselves. Share with God's people who are in need. Practice hospitality. Do not be proud, but be willing to associate with people of low position. Do not be conceited." James warned against the sin of favoritism in the church meeting, of welcoming the rich and prosperous-looking man, giving him a good seat up front, with more respect and honor than someone who comes in with poor, shabby clothes looking a bit disreputable. Jesus was continually criticized by the religious people for his friends. He was known for welcoming, hanging out with, eating and partying with tax collectors, sinners, and prostitutes. Our son Ben used to work with a woman in a bonsai nursery who, when she was younger, she was really searching for truth, and she went into a Christian church the first time, and in fact, I think the last time she ever went into a Christian church. She was wearing jeans, went into church, and one of the ushers came and reprimanded her for appearing in God's house dressed like that. She walked out and never came back. She's a Buddhist now. Paul corrected the Corinthians, who thought he wanted them to avoid associating with non-Christians who were sexually immoral, greedy, and swindlers. He wrote, "No, of course not. You've completely misunderstood me. To avoid associating with sexually immoral non-Christians would mean leaving the world, and that's not an option for you. Christians are not allowed to leave the world. You are to be in the world, but not of the world." It's a really striking passage. And then he corrected them and said, what I meant was, I'm speaking about church discipline of sexually immoral Christians who refuse correction. I wasn't telling you to avoid non-Christians. You'd have to leave the world. You're not allowed to do that. Okay, my next section is to look at some of the costs and risks of hospitality. And I would be lying if I claimed there were no costs or risks in opening your home to strangers. It costs money, and property and possessions get worn, damaged, broken, and sometimes stolen. A woman at one of my hospitality workshops at a conference objected, "Isn't that bad stewardship of the property God has given us to take care of?" Well, I guess we have to ask, what is the purpose of the material possessions God has made us stewards of? Is it to clean them, polish them, ensure them, and protect them so we can hand them over to God in perfect condition when we leave this life? Are we meant to store up our money so we can take a wad with us when we die? The parable of the rich fool begins with Jesus' warning, "Be on your guard against all kinds of greed, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of possessions." He then tells the story of a man whose land produced more than he had space for, so he built bigger storage barns for, quote, all his grain and goods. And then he said to himself, "Soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, and be merry." But God said to him, "You fool, this very night your life is being demanded of you. And the things you have prepared, whose will they be?" So it is with those who store up treasures for themselves, but are not rich toward God. In the parable of the unjust steward, in Luke 16, Jesus teaches that good stewardship of our money and property, or being rich toward God, involves using it for people. He says, "I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves, so that when it, the money, is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings." In other words, if we use our wealth to serve people now, there will be people to receive us in our eternal home who would not otherwise have been there. Jesus also says that the wealth we are stewards of in this life doesn't actually belong to us. It belongs to God. But if we're trustworthy with it now, he will give us responsibility for the true riches, which will belong to us forever. And again, what is being trustworthy with it? It's using it. It's being rich toward God, using it for people. Jesus concludes, saying to the Pharisees who loved money, "You cannot serve both God and money. Serving God is using your money and possessions for people. Hospitality is a way of resisting the grip our things can exert on us. It's a way of resisting the idolatry of materialism." Francis Schaeffer used to contradict the adage that you can't take it with you. when you die. He argues that it all depends on what you try to take with you. We certainly cannot take our bank accounts, land, houses, musical instruments, antique furniture, swimming pools, sports cars, motorcycles, and worldly status. But if we are rich toward God by using our abilities, property, and resources generously for people now, then we'll take people with us. And Scripture says, our good works will follow us. That's a really interesting phrase from the book of Revelation. Our good works will follow us. They will not precede us, opening our way to heaven. We don't get into heaven by our good works. But our good works will follow us. Only God's grace can get us in, can go before us. But our good works will bear fruit that will come with us. And as Schaeffer used to say, will last forever. Will send ripples that will go on forever. But hospitality can be risky. People may take advantage of you. They may damage and break things. Many years ago, a woman, this is when we were living in this house, just up there where the chestnuts are now, a woman who couldn't find my ironing board decided to iron on my dining room table. She damaged the finish of my grandmother's table that I had inherited. Her only comment was, oh, it's only moth and rust. Which, of course, is true. But had she apologized and shown some regret, I would have found it a lot easier. On another occasion, I sent a student out to pick beans for dinner. She stripped every plant of every bean down to this size bean, which should have fed us for another month, was gone. Of course, I should have taken her out and shown her which size beans to pick and which ones to leave on the plants. And I've learned not to assume that anybody knows anything about gardening or various other things as well. But just that you've got to show people, show them. And it's better to make, you know, to be, if they're expert gardeners, their feelings might be hurt for a moment, but then you can tell them that story and make them feel better. Didn't know. People may steal things. They may expose you to infectious diseases. They may resist leaving. That actually happens here almost at the end of almost every term. There are people who have a really hard time leaving when it's the end of the term. Anyway, fear and self-protection may keep us from risking hospitality. Again, concerns about costs and risks are not a new phenomenon. Both Luther and Calvin believed that hospitality was easier and safer for the Old Testament patriarchs than for Christians in the 16th century. For Luther wrote, quote, there was not such a large number of vagabonds and scoundrels in the world as there are today. Now, I'm not sure how he knew that. Didn't get to ask Abraham. Anyway, Calvin urged the citizens of Geneva to welcome persecuted Protestants as a sacred duty. But as the numbers of refugees swelled, the local population of Geneva lost enthusiasm. They felt the drain on their resources and feared that skilled refugees would threaten their jobs. This exact issue is obviously a huge and extremely complex problem right now as thousands of Syrian and other refugees flood into Germany, the Netherlands, and other European countries. A former Labrie student who is now a pastor in Hungary has asked us for his prayers. We've been praying for him every Monday at our Monday morning prayer meetings, as he and other Christians in Hungary are trying to help refugees at a time when the Hungarian government is closing its borders to them. The rules governing 5th and 6th century monasteries were designed to guard against guests who were, quote, thieves or mischief makers, parasites or loafers. So there were rules for these monasteries, trying to have some control over who came. But the risks were never seen as a legitimate reason to neglect hospitality to strangers. Rather, the risks were faced and minimized as much as possible. Luther recommended that hosts get references for strangers from trusted persons, as was often done in the New Testament and early church period. And monasteries kept a close eye on guests and insisted that they help with the work. Generally speaking, in the past, households were much larger and more full of activities than is true today. The modern, small, privatized household, which is disconnected from a larger church or community and is frequently empty, can pose a different kind of risk. Christine Pohl writes of the need for more public threshold settings in which to meet strangers, places that can function as bridges between public and private space. This can be done when churches and social service institutions collaborate to place individuals in appropriate homes. Over the years, LaBrie has been a kind of bridge for several local families who have offered hospitality to some of our student guests after leaving here. We have been very thankful for these families. One of them is here tonight. But the people they've taken are not total strangers, because we've known them and they've come with our recommendation. Dick and I have learned from a number of mistakes, which I'll mention throughout this time, this talk. When we were living in London, Dick pastored a very multi-class, multicultural church that met in our home, which was the house also owned by LaBrie. And it was a church that met in the LaBrie house. There were two probation officers in our church, which gave us a ministry to ex-convicts. Once we had our front door busted in, and so did another member of the church by another ex-convict, who both were coming to church and had become Christians. Dick had a sheepskin coat and two guitars stolen by people who stayed with us or came to church. They also left, some drug addicts left syringes and flower pots in rooms where we had Sunday school classes. We learned what should have been obvious, which is that drug addicts, people who are actively on drugs now, needed a much more structured environment than we could give them. Another man who was an alcoholic and chronic thief frequently showed up for meals. Every time he came, he would steal something, even the time he came to apologize for stealing something the time before. Eventually, we realized we were not helping him by making it so easy for him to rip us off. You know, like he'd say, we have to go to the bathroom, and that was, we have to follow him to the bathroom. You didn't want him to steal something. But we were sick of getting ripped off, so from then on, we brought sandwiches out to him on the front steps and ate with him there. So we changed the form of our hospitality. We said, you can't come in the house. You can't even come to say sorry without stealing something, so you can't come in our house anymore. But we can have a peanut butter sandwich with you out on the front step. So we changed our form of hospitality, but we never regretted trying to help him. I have no idea whether there was any lasting. Alcohol was such an issue for him. I don't know what lasting help we were. Dr. Schaefer wrote this. In the first 3 years of LaBrie, all our wedding presents were wiped out. Our sheets were torn, holes were burned in our rugs, people vomited in our rooms. You don't need a big program. All you need to do is open your home and begin. And there is no place in God's world where there are no people who will come and share a home as long as it is a real home. This is what the love of God means. This is the admonition to the elder, that he must be given to hospitality. If you have never done any things of this nature, if you've been quiet, especially as our culture is crumbling about us, if this is so, do you really believe people are lost? And if you really believe that, how can you stand and say, I never paid the price to open my living place and do the things I can? Close quote. So we've talked about some of the risks and costs of hospitality. I want to talk about some of the blessings of hospitality. God commands us to practice hospitality, and obedience brings its own blessings. Christine Pohl points out that many of the biblical narratives of hospitality have elements of mystery and surprise. They reveal God's unexpected presence, bringing an experience of transcendence into very mundane human interactions. Some needy strangers turned out to be angels. And the writer of Hebrews says that could happen to us. There was a woman who spent many years at the Swiss LaBrie, sort of appeared from nowhere, was taken in, and the Schaefers seriously wondered if she might have been an angel. She had no family, and she stayed there until she died. She had cerebral palsy, and she had certain jobs. She set the table, and she was just part of Swiss LaBrie for many, many years. And they really had no idea where she came from. And seriously, I question, maybe she's an angel. When the widow of Zarephath offered what she believed to be her last meal to Elijah, her small supply of meal and oil was miraculously replenished daily until the famine was over. The Shunammite woman who welcomed Elisha received the blessing of a son and his restored life when he died from a heat stroke. The hosts in these biblical stories were blessed by their willing hospitality. Scripture also tells stories of men who were deliberately inhospitable, Nabal, the men of Sodom, and of Gibeah, and they were severely judged as foolish and evil. Jesus taught that when you welcome even the least person into your home and life, you welcome him. This may strike us as strange, but in the early centuries of the church, Christians took quite literally the words of Jesus in Matthew 25, where he described the separation of the sheep from the goats in the final judgment. To the sheep, the king said, "Come, O blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me." Then the righteous will answer him, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? And when did we see you a stranger and welcome you?" And the king will answer them, "Truly I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of these my brothers and sisters, you did it to me." So as we practice hospitality, we are blessed by the presence of Jesus. And this text promises the future blessing of inheriting the kingdom prepared by God from the foundations of the world. In this parable, Jesus describes a spirit of hospitality as evidence of saving faith. No, it's not the basis for salvation. Only faith in Christ and Christ's work can save us. But the story shows a spirit of hospitality as evidence that people have saving faith, that they have received God's hospitality and have a knee-jerk reaction of hospitality outward, because they were surprised. When did we do it? They weren't trying to earn salvation. They were just had a knee-jerk response of hospitality as a result of having experienced God's hospitality to them. Christine Pohl writes, "This has been the most important passage for the entire tradition on Christian hospitality. I was a stranger and you welcomed me resounds throughout all the ancient texts. And contemporary practitioners of hospitality refer to this text more often than any other passage. Acts of welcoming the stranger or leaving someone outside take on intensely heightened significance when it is Jesus himself who experiences the consequences of our ministry or the lack of it. In remembering Jesus as host who fed multitudes and welcomed children, prostitutes, and other despised people, we may forget the ways in which he was also a needy stranger. He was a homeless infant, a child refugee, an adult with no place to lay his head, and a despised convict. John tells us that he came to his own home, to the world he'd created, and received no welcome, but was rejected as a fraud. Martin Luther wrote that when persecuted believers were received hospitably, God himself is in our home, is being fed at our house, is lying down and resting. John Calvin viewed such hospitality as a sacred duty and urged believers to see in the stranger the image of God and our common flesh. Hospitality has blessed all of us who've worked in Libri. We frequently feel humbled and awed by evidence that the transcendent God is working in individuals and relationships in the midst of the very imperfect and mostly mundane activities of our day-to-day life. We've also experienced God's financial provision, often in the nick of time when finances are low and we fear we may have to close our doors. From the beginning of Libri, workers have prayed that God would bring the people of his choice and keep others away. Over the years, our lives and our children's have been stretched and enriched by the amazing diversity of people who come to stay with us. Their gifts and varied experiences have contributed to our community in ways only God could have orchestrated, and some have become lifelong friends who've welcomed us into their homes when we travel, or our children into their homes. Some of our students have suffered as a result of their own bad choices. Our boys, who are grown now, got to know them, but when they were growing up at home, the boys at home, they got to know these folks in the safety of our home and often grieved with them over the consequences of some of those bad choices. There's also the blessing of seeing hospitality multiply as guests decide to open their own spaces to others or to introduce one communal sit-down meal, shared meal a day into their households to encourage real conversation and sharing. And I want to speak now briefly about the importance of shared meals in the Bible. And Christine Pohl speaks quite a lot about this in her book. In shared meals, the presence of God's kingdom is prefigured, revealed, and reflected. Jesus, as host, feeds over 5,000 people and later explains that he is the bread of life and living water for all who thirst. The Lord's Supper continually reenacts the center of the gospel, the breaking of Christ's body and the shedding of his blood, to give us life and nourishment. And celebrating the Lord's Supper with other believers is an experience of God's new community and foreshadows the great marriage feast of the Lamb, which we all look forward to. After his resurrection, Jesus walked with two disciples on the road to Emmaus. He came to them as a stranger. They didn't recognize him. They welcomed him as a guest, and in breaking bread together, he became host, and they recognized him. In the early church, shared meals were a significant setting for struggling with cultural boundaries, particularly the inclusion of Gentiles into the people of God, and in dealing with tensions between rich and poor. Sharing meals was a visible demonstration of equality, transformed relationships, and a common life. Human equality was a totally new and non-intuitive concept in the ancient world. Even a vision from God at the home of Cornelius wasn't enough to prevent Peter from falling back into the attitude of Jewish superiority and refusing to eat with Gentiles. It took Paul's public rebuke to make him realize how central the principle of human equality was to the gospel, and how eating with Gentiles demonstrated human equality in Christ. Throughout history, the people one eats with has had enormous social significance. The sister novelists Charlotte and Anne Bronte wrote of the degrading experience of being a governess, which was one of the very few acceptable occupations for educated, unmarried, middle-class women in their day. One of the most galling aspects of that position was that governesses had to eat alone. They were considered too low in status to eat with their employers, the lords and ladies whose children they taught, but too high in status to eat with the servants. And you get a flavor of this in Charlotte's novel, Jane Eyre. Christine Pohl writes, "Early Christian writers claimed that transcending social and ethnic differences by sharing meals, homes, and worship with persons of different backgrounds was a proof of the truth of the Christian faith." And now I want to say a little bit about Francis Schaeffer's book, The Mark of the Christian, and speak about hospitality as a mark of the Christian. In this short book, Francis Schaeffer argues that the universal mark or sign that one is a Christian is love. At the close of his ministry, Jesus said to his disciples, "I give you a new commandment, that you love one another. Just as I have loved you, you also should love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another." And Jesus prayed to the Father for his disciples and all who would ever believe in him. That includes those of us in this room who are believers. "That they may become completely one, so that the world may know that you have sent me and have loved them even as you have loved me." So he prayed the world would know that God, the Father, sent the Son and has loved us even as the Father loved the Son. Jesus summarized the whole of God's law in the two great commandments, to love God and to love our neighbors as ourselves. Even more striking, he commanded, "Love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be children of your Father in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and he sends rain on the righteous and on the unrighteous." It's impossible to love humanity in general. The love that demonstrates the truth of the Christian faith is practical, visible, embodied love. Francis Schaeffer called love the mark of the Christian and the final apologetic. He argued, if the world may know that the Father sent the Son by observing Christians' love for one another, then the opposite is also true. The world will not know that the Father sent the Son if Christians do not love one another. The world will conclude that Christian truth claims are false. One of the strongest early attestations to the apologetic power of Christian love and hospitality came from a hostile source, from the pagan emperor Julian around AD 362. Paul writes, "In his attempt to reestablish Hellenic polytheistic religion in the empire, the emperor Julian instructed the high priest of the Hellenic faith to imitate Christian concern for strangers. Referring to Christianity as atheism, which is how Romans in the first century saw Christianity. Christians were called atheists because they didn't believe in the whole pantheon of gods. He asked, why do we not observe that it is their benevolence to strangers, their care for the graves of the dead, and the pretended holiness of their lives that have done most to increase atheism? In other words, to spread Christianity. He therefore instructed the pagan priests to establish hostels for needy strangers in every city, and he also ordered a distribution of corn and wine to the poor, to strangers, and to beggars. Quote, he wrote, for it is disgraceful that when no Jew ever has to beg, because Jews cared for their own, for each other, and the impious Galileans, that's the Christians, the impious Galileans, support not only their own poor, but ours as well. All men see that our people lack aid from us. Teach those of the Hellenic polytheistic faith to contribute to public service of this sort. Close quote. The presence of this letter is very credible evidence that the early Christians took seriously Paul and Jesus' admonition to love all people, including even their enemies and those who persecuted them. The Christians' love did put the pagans to shame, and that love was a large cause for the growth of the church. Christian love also functioned as salt and light, improving society, since it motivated pagans to alleviate the suffering of the poor as well. This becomes clear as we contrast the Hellenistic and Christian practice of hospitality in the ancient world. So I just want to speak briefly about the distinctiveness of Christian hospitality in its cultural setting. I mentioned the central importance of Matthew 25 for the early Christian practice of hospitality. Their understanding that in welcoming the stranger, they were welcoming Jesus himself. The second most defining text in Christian history has been Luke 14, verses 12 to 14. When you give a dinner party, don't invite your friends, your brothers or relatives, or your rich neighbors, those who will repay you. Invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed. Although they cannot repay you, you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. This text helps define what became a distinctively Christian understanding of hospitality in the early centuries of the church. Hospitality was to be extended to the neediest and weakest, those who were least likely to be able to reciprocate. Hellenistic practices of hospitality and benevolence couldn't have been more different. They were based on formal, reciprocal obligations between a benefactor and a recipient. Cicero wrote, "The houses of illustrious men should be open to illustrious guests." This tradition emphasized the worthiness and goodness of the recipients rather than their need. One early Christian writer called pagan hospitality ambitious and offered for the advantage of the host. For early church leaders, Chrysostom, Lactantius, Jerome, and others, Paul writes, Christian hospitality was to be remedial, counteracting the formidable social stratification of the larger society by providing a modest and equal welcome to everyone. High social status was not to be honored with special recognition by Christians. In fact, to entertain persons who had few needs was not really considered hospitality at all. Paul continues, hospitality to needy strangers distinguished the early church from its surrounding environment. Noted as exceptional by Christians and non-Christians alike, offering care to strangers became one of the distinguishing marks of the authenticity of the Christian gospel and of the church. I want to think now about some practical suggestions ways of reaching out to people. My experience with hospitality started with my parents, who were incredibly hospitable people. And no doubt, my family background predisposed me to be drawn to a work like Le Brie. We often describe Le Brie as a residential study community dependent on prayer for our direction and support. As such, we are a full-time ministry of hospitality, including several worker households. This enables us to practice hospitality in a way that's not possible in exactly the same way for individuals, families, and churches. But many of the lessons we have learned and are still learning can be adapted to other settings. Hospitality should start at home with a loving and welcoming attitude toward your family or those you live with. and an atmosphere characterized by grace. It moves in wider circles out from the home. Sharing at least one family meal together each day can be a radical idea today in many settings. But it's crucial for household members to sit down together to converse and listen to each other. And if this doesn't happen at meals, when is it likely to happen? Recent studies have shown, not surprisingly, that teens who experience this in their homes are less likely to get pregnant and experiment with other risky behaviors. Hospitality means valuing a child's feeling more than the floor you just mopped when the child comes in with muddy feet. It means an attitude of welcome and grace for teenage children and their friends, and the wisdom to not treat everything as a moral issue, i.e. hair length and color, dreadlocks, weird clothes, earrings, nose rings, choice of music, tidiness, etc. They're not all moral issues. The Bible commands hospitality and care for elderly parents and other extended family members. If anyone does not provide for his or her relatives, they have denied the faith and are worse than unbelievers. Well, that's from 1 Timothy. Most of the world looks with horror at the too common American neglect and lack of respect for the elderly. Hospitality can be extended to neighbors and acquaintances, employees and employers, colleagues, children's teachers and coaches, doctors, builders, repairmen, etc. If one has extra food prepared, it's easier to invite a visitor or someone you don't know home from church. Hospitality to people who are away from home, including foreign students at a local university, is a wonderful ministry, or medical residents at a local hospital. Colleges are looking for families to host foreign students during school holidays. Several years ago, we met a plastic surgeon from the Mayo Clinic and his wife. They opened their home to some of his patients who've come a long distance for treatment, and many had terminal diseases and had been deserted by their spouses because of the terminal diseases. When we lived in London, our son Tim, who was a toddler at the time, cut his head falling off a kitchen stool, and we took him to the emergency room at a local hospital. We were appalled to learn that the Egyptian doctor who stitched him up had been living in England for over a year and had never once been invited into an English home. So we invited him for Christmas Day, along with an American physician who'd lived in Afghanistan and an Indian physician. It was a totally fascinating day for all of us. Hearing them, just listening to the three of them talk was fascinating. A pregnancy resource center may put you in touch with a pregnant girl who needs a temporary place to stay and help making plans. You probably don't realize that the first shelters and safe homes for battered women were provided by secular feminists who, in costly compassion, opened their homes to abused women and children. Hospitality to needy children, neighborhood kids who come home to an empty house. Big brother, big sister programs can be a good, I've known of people who found those very helpful. Given how often Scripture commands care for the fatherless, it's hard to understand why more Christians don't foster and adopt children as they did in the early church. I recommend to you an organization called FaithBridge, which is working in Georgia, and I hope expanding to other states, and there probably are other works like this. But it was started by a man who came up through the foster care system and was homeless and in prison for a while. Somewhere along the line, he became a Christian, and he started a ministry to encourage and train Christians to foster and adopt children. He speaks in churches around in Georgia, telling his story, then laying out the facts of the state foster care system and the Bible's teaching on caring for the fatherless. He then trains families who want to foster or adopt and other families to support those families. His training has been so effective that the state of Georgia Social Services have asked FaithBridge to do their training for them. Just this past September, just a month ago, I flew down to Georgia to be present when our adopted grandson, Walker, and four other adopted children were all baptized at our son's church. It was a very moving experience. The pastor, in fact, has adopted twin daughters, and there were several others who all were in the same baptism service. A church can do a lot that a single person or family cannot handle alone. Park Street Church in Boston and Redeemer Community Church in Needham are just two local churches I happen to know about who have projects to help with the refugee crisis in Europe. But churches can also share care for a local refugee family housing, teaching in English, giving jobs, collecting pots and pans and clothing and other household items. Our friends Marty and Elliot Larson, who lived in Afghanistan for many years and then were here in Southborough for quite a while, they enabled an Afghan family to move to the United States by offering to be their sponsor, which I think involves some financial and other kinds of support. When we lived in London with a church meeting in our home, we encouraged church members to live within walking distance so they could share in hospitality and care for the needy among us, most of whom had no cars. These included some ex-convicts, people looking for work, single mothers and their children, and people trying to stay off drugs. Foreign missions are obviously important, but church mission budgets should not neglect the needs of local people the Bible speaks of repeatedly. Single mothers and their children have been called the new poor. They make up a growing proportion of the homeless population. We can also take hospitality to those who cannot come to us, in prisons, hospitals, nursing homes, institutions, for disabled folk, orphanages, and so on. Jesus frequently spoke about visiting prisoners. Or by supporting a responsible faraway mission, like Help a Child, which supports poor families and also provides homes, Christian education, medical care, and job training to orphans in India and Africa. Help a Child was founded by a Dutch livery worker, Anki Rickmacher. And there's what you might call radical hospitality, radical in the sense that the risks are even greater. The book Lest Innocent Blood Be Shed by Philip Halley is the story of a Protestant village in southern France that hid Jewish children during the Holocaust. Under the brilliant organization of the pastor, the whole village was involved. The teenage Bible study group was the nerve center of the whole operation, taking messages to and from farmers by bicycle. Not one of the 2,000 to 3,000 Jewish children who were hidden were ever caught. The villagers in Le Chambon never thought they were doing anything heroic. They had always practiced Christian hospitality, and they saw no reason to stop simply because it had become so dangerous. The same was true of Corrie Ten Boom and her family. They weren't setting out to be heroes. They just had always practiced hospitality. Why should they change it? Because the risks were greater for them. My last section is the need for setting limits and boundaries. Whether an organization like Labrie, a church, or an individual household, we must be realistic about our limitations and the need for boundaries. We can't open our doors to everyone in need. Edith Schaefer used to say it's arrogant to believe we can. We need to pray for wisdom to know what we can do, realizing that the shape of hospitality we can offer will be different at different chapters of our lives. Christine Pohl writes, "People who become known for their generous response to strangers often find increasing numbers of strangers at their door, whether it is the door of a home, a church, or community. Hosts can find themselves stretched to their limits. Energy, resources, space, identity, and cohesion of the family or the community are strained. Faced with such pressures, host communities either work out guidelines or give up hospitality, or the community itself gradually disintegrates." That's the end of Pohl's quote. This is an enormous and complex challenge today for European nations, not just individual churches or homes, but nations who've welcomed or are welcoming large numbers of refugees with very different religious and cultural identities. Miroslav Volf writes in Exclusion and Embrace, "The will to give ourselves to others and welcome them necessitates that we, quote, readjust our identities to make space for them. I.e., we can't practice hospitality and stay exactly the same. Our identity is stretched, but we cannot afford to lose it altogether." Pohl writes of the tension which must therefore be negotiated between, quote, maintaining identity boundaries and welcoming strangers. For example, Labrie has an identity, shape, and purpose as a residential Christian study community. If one of our guests is seriously undermining our identity and mission and refuses to be corrected, we need to ask them to leave because it's not fair to our families or to our other guests. Thankfully, this has happened only a handful of times in the history of Labrie. Similarly, in an individual household, it's crucial to guard the integrity, identity, and needs of the household members, whether married, single, with or without children. Married couples must protect their marriages. While living in England, we met two idealistic young couples who bought a house together in order to have a ministry of hospitality. After a while, one of the wives ran off with a troubled young man who was staying with them. They clearly had not taken seriously their own vulnerability to temptation, and they hadn't guarded against it. Children need to know that their parents are on their side in protecting their needs, including their time, their space, and their possessions. We don't teach our children to be generous by continually forcing them to give up their rooms and share their things. They learn by our modeling. Over the years, many neglected and hurt children of ministers and missionaries have come to the different branches of Labrie. Their parents had time for everybody else's children, but not for them. Some have reacted in bitterness not only against their parents, but against the Lord and against the faith. In London, when a church met in our home, we unwisely used our young boy's bedroom for a Sunday school classroom every Sunday morning. That was until we realized how incredibly hard this was for our boys. And we realized then, whoa, this was a big mistake. We apologized to them and reorganized things so as to safeguard their space and possessions. They needed to know their parents were on their side in protecting their space and their things. As children grow, they should be involved in decision-making about hospitality. One more example of learning from mistakes, Nick and I learned while living in London. A young man stayed with us on two different occasions. The first time he stayed, he came and went as he liked, brought his friends with him without asking us, and basically used our home as a crash pad. We realized we were allowing him to make the atmosphere in our home, and we resented it. Later on, then he moved out. I forget exactly why or what happened, whether we asked him to or not. But later on, he came to us again and asked if he could stay. Having quit school and left home in his early teens, he was now desperately trying to study to take the exams that would qualify him to go to university. He was squatting in a deserted house with a group of drug addicts who were breaking into drugstores at night. Clearly, the atmosphere was incredibly unhelpful to his goals. And he knew he wasn't strong enough to handle the situation for much longer. So he came with a real sense of humility and asked, please, would we let him stay with us again? This time we didn't give him an answer immediately. But after thinking, talking, and praying about it, we decided he could stay, but with conditions. So we gave him a curfew. We asked him to help with certain chores. We expected him to have certain meals with us each week and to attend the weekly Bible study and Sunday worship that took place in our home. By taking responsibility for the atmosphere in our home and setting some appropriate boundaries, we avoided the feeling of resentment that we had struggled with earlier. And the experience was much better for him as well. In some ways, we were reparenting him. We provided a discipline structure that he needed in order to learn self-discipline, something that usually happens when people are younger, but in his case it hadn't. And he could blame us for having to leave the pub early. He'd say to his friends, I'm living in a church and they'll kick me out if I'm late. He did pass his exams, went to university and graduate school, and became a social worker. 25 years later, when we were living in this house, he phoned us out of the blue to thank us for our hospitality to him at what turned out to be a pivotal time in his life. He said that those few months changed the direction of his life. Of course, we didn't have that information at the time. We knew having him stay was a risk, but one we are so thankful we took. But again, with boundaries this time, and he knew if he didn't stick to them, we'd ask him to leave. So in conclusion, I'd like to end with an admonition from the Apostle Peter's first letter, written at the beginning of Nero's brutal persecution of Christians. Peter wrote, "The end of all things is near. Therefore, be clear-minded and self-controlled so that you can pray. Above all, love each other deeply, because love covers over a multitude of sins. Offer hospitality to one another without grumbling. Each one should use whatever gift he or she has received to serve others." I'm sure you're all aware, world history is full of examples of bizarre things people have done who were sure that the end of all things was near. Some of the Thessalonian Christians stopped working, and Paul had to tell them to work. He said, if you don't work, you don't eat. Work. Some people have waited on mountaintops, vowing to fast until Christ returned, sure of the date. In preparation for the end in Y2K, many Christians collected vast stocks, not just Christians, many people in general, collected vast stocks of food and firearms and moved into shelters to wait for the end. Peter's admonition stands in amazing contrast. The end of all things is near. Therefore, pray. And above all, love each other deeply and offer hospitality without grumbling, because the end is near. Amazing. That's where I'll end. And I welcome comments, questions, and really hope that many of you can join us tomorrow and we can continue and have more time for discussion. Please, those of you who may not have been here before, we believe in discussion, so we have discussion for as long as people want to, but if you have to leave, feel free to leave. My feelings won't be hurt. We know that not everybody can stay for as long as some people like to stay. So. Yeah.
Can you give your definition of hospitality?
Oh, yeah. Philoxenia literally means loving the stranger. It's a combination of the word phileo, which is the love, brotherly, sisterly love, love for kin, brothers and sisters in the faith. Bye. Thanks for coming. Xenia is stranger. So it's extending the love, the brotherly, sisterly love to strangers. That's the literal meaning of it. And it can take, obviously, lots of different
forms. It's interesting in that way he says that show hospitality to one another. They're not strangers, they're brothers and sisters.
No. I think it's hospitality is loving any, you know, it's a practical way of showing your love for anyone. But the literal meaning of the word was strangers. And I think that was what was so unique about Christian hospitality, is that it wasn't only extended to brothers and sisters and neighbors and friends, but it was extended to the needy and to strangers, to people that you didn't know necessarily. Yeah. Yeah.
I was struck by the relationship between the word hospitality and hospital. And I'm wondering if you know about the meaning of the English words. You gave the Greek equivalent.
Yeah.
Do you know where those words come from and how they're connected?
Does anyone know? I don't. I bet Christine talks about that in her book.
There is something on that I think in Christine Pohl's other book, which is called Living into Community. Mm-hmm. Marty was talking about it.
Yeah.
I read it. I can't remember.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah, I mean, it's certainly, in English at least, it sort of sounds like it's got the same root, hospital and hospitality.
Probably does.
Mm-hmm. But I couldn't tell you. But it is really intriguing that it was Christians were the first people to open hospitals for anyone, not just soldiers who hadn't been injured so much, who'd been injured little enough that they could return to the war. Yeah.
I think the root for hospital and hospitality is the Latin for guest.
Oh, interesting. Thank you. This is where Latin would help. I never. I was. That is interesting. Anybody? Any Latin scholars here, or anyone who?
Any dictionary on the wall?
Yeah, I'm sure there are some. Anyone Google? Sorry. Yeah. That's fine.
Well, actually, too. In the Middle East, I'm Middle Eastern, Palestinian.
Yeah.
That love of strangers, or that hosting of strangers, is just a given.
Absolutely.
My family is from Palestine, and that was what they do. But the other thing I wanted to ask you about was the other end of hospitality is to be able to receive it.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed we have a home church, and you know, we always make coffee, we always whatever to prepare, like you do.
Yeah.
And people bring their little styrofoam cups in. Yeah. And, you know, you don't, they like that cup for some reason, but sometimes, no, really, they have a reason to like but maybe it's my background, but people sometimes don't know how to receive it.
Hmm.
And I don't know how to teach that.
Hmm.
And, you know, the more hospitable sometimes you are, the less they know how to receive it.
Hmm.
But I think that's partly maybe what you talked about, how people don't do it. There's nobody home.
Mm-hmm.
They're not busy, or they're busy.
Yeah.
But I have noticed that.
Interesting. I wonder if some of it is because of the sense that I have to reciprocate. I mean, I actually had a neighbor a long time ago, she doesn't live here now, but say something like that to me, which really surprised me, but was because we'd have them for dinner. Well, it's my turn now.
Mm-hmm.
We have to have you for dinner. And it was this kind of sense that there's got to be a tit for tat, you know. Yeah, I don't know. But I think I love the Charles Dickens quote, you know, that we're not another race of creatures bound on other journeys, but we're all fellow travelers to the grave. And there's something very, in the biblical teaching on love and hospitality, it's not condescending, like, you know, I'm Lady Bountiful, who always will be on the giving end to give to you, because there's really the teaching right throughout that we're all utterly vulnerable, that I may have the wherewithal to share with you today, but I may have a stroke, I may be hit by a car, I may lose all my money in the stock market, and I'm just as vulnerable to death and to all these accidents and things that, as anyone else. So I need to be, not to feel like I'm always in the position, you know, some people have to be always in the position of the ones that are giving. And I think if we have the humility to realize we're all vulnerable, and the strength I have today I may not have tomorrow, and I may be the recipient of, may need to be the recipient of all kinds of generosity of people. That can. Yeah.
I mean, really.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But that isn't anyone else. I just want to contribute to that. Yeah.
I've noticed that it's different in different cultures. So.
Yeah, very much.
There's this really complex code for giving and receiving in Japan.
Hmm.
And you can insult someone by giving them something they can't reciprocate.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I wasn't there long enough to really get a good sense of it. But it was very delicate how you hosted people. But people were very welcoming.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting.
And very friendly. But there's another culture clash that I came across was I stayed at an Indian reservation where people could die of exposure. So you gave because you wanted to make sure your neighbors stayed alive and their kids were fed.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't ask for thanks. You didn't make a big deal of it. You didn't say, well, I'm the giving one,
and
you can give me respect. You never did that. You let them have their dignity because that was just survival.
Mm-hmm.
But I grew up in a WASP family, you know,
mm-hmm.
Northeastern family, where you expected to thank people all the time.
Yeah.
And you expected to treat their gifts with extra special care because they'd given it.
Yeah.
As if it wasn't really yours. And mm-hmm. there was sort of like, if someone gave you a gift, they could then turn it into something that you aren't getting.
Or an obligation. Yeah.
But there's another thing that's happening now is that, I mean, in the 70s when I grew up, if you had a flat tire and couldn't change it, people would stop.
Mm-hmm.
Now everyone assumes that you can help yourself. And if someone stops, they're afraid they're there to mug you.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this fear.
Really,
that
yeah.
if someone
there is more fear.
They want something.
Yeah.
So it's, I don't really know how to answer that question, but it is so different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, true. You know, our friends, the Larsons, who lived in Afghanistan all those years, and then in Southborough, they found it difficult because when they've been back to, well, when they were living there, but also when they've been back, because they went back to work later, is that their Afghan friends and neighbors would just know that these people would go broke showing them hospitality. They would, you know, they would kill a goat that's, you know, and eat the whole thing and basically offer them so much more than they actually needed or could even eat. But it was only polite to eat it, but also it the Larsons found it really difficult because they knew this family couldn't afford to be this generous. So you're right. There's incredible cultural complexity. The wrong thing. Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to say, Marty, last term and this term, the topic of being able to accept hospitality has come up over meals. And it is an important aspect. It's not just hospitality, is not just giving, but it is also giving. And I think, you know, maybe in the setting that you're in, with having a regular group of people come in your home and having that, being able to have that conversation, and even just saying, it's important to be able to receive as well as to give, and just kind of making people aware. I know it has helped me to be able to receive better, more gracefully, I think, I hope. And you want to be able to offer them the nice cups and not have them feel like they need to bring cups from home.
Oh, I do, actually. 8 years.
Right.
You don't all do that.
So. Right. but you notice it when...
Well, it's something I've noticed. Don't get me wrong when I say this, I'm quoting my mother. I've noticed this about Americans. I mean, I was born in this country, but my mother always noticed it. And so I see it now, that people are disconnected, and they're more and more so than they were when I was a girl in the 50s. Mm-hmm. So, and it's difficult to teach that without offending.
Right.
People have their idea of how they'd like it to be. But I know there's another side to what you're teaching. Mm-hmm. I mean, we need to know what you're teaching, because we do it whether they do receive it or not. I mean, it's not the fact that we only do it if they receive it. But I'd like to be able to teach it. I'd like to be able to communicate it.
Well, and I think a huge part of receiving it is kind of humbling yourself to receive it. And that's the difficult part of it.
Martha.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, playing on that I think... You know, to receive hospitality, I think you have to be humble. So I think it requires humility as well as vulnerability. And I think those are very difficult notions for us. And I think in countries that are affluent, I think we are, and people are used to being able to provide for themselves and depend on themselves as opposed to others. You know, so you buy those things for yourself that you need. Mm-hmm. So bringing your own cup is actually, in a sense, you know, you know, you feel more confident, you know, that you know what's happening. This is my cup. Of being able to, you know, just stand on your own and actually putting that down and just being so whatever. And it's interesting because even within Lobby, I think people can feel like that, you know, the guests would come and actually they do pay a certain fee, no matter how much it covers. But I had an experience of cooking for a large number of people, and there was a girl who would not eat meat, not eat beef, actually. It wasn't an allergy, it was a preference.
Yeah.
And she basically, you know, I cooked a meal for like 40 people, and she refused to eat it. And I felt so hurt, because I thought, gosh, if I invite somebody in my home, and they would sit down and look at it, gosh, you know, this is beef, that's disgusting, I'm not going to eat it. Now I would feel hurt, and that would be awkward. Mm-hmm. And she went away and came back the next term and apologized and said, look, I'm so sorry, I was invited to, in a small setting, to one family, and I sat down to that, you know, table, and they served me something I would never eat, but I realized I couldn't just stand in there. But I think many people sort of get cheated, like, I'm in a restaurant, I'm invited, I paid for it, so you serve what I want.
Yeah.
And she actually realized in a different setting that that was the same thing, you know, just with 40 people. So I think they're just used to being able to pay for it and feeling confident.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Get for us.
Yeah.
So I think we need to be humble.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mary, thank you.
Connected to that, my apologies to the brief minister, because I beat this drum loudly and repeatedly around here. But a piece of it I do. But it's so connected to what Marta said, I think, especially in the West, we have individualism is so strong. Mm-hmm. We have this restaurant culture, but we live in a culture where we can get our hands on anything when we want it and the exact thing that we want. And so I find that at Liberty too, I think very often sometimes people aren't even, they're not even conscious of it, they're not even aware of it. But the idea of, I mean, I've said this before to Liberty students when I serve meals, I think, you know,
I'm serving something that I think is good. I'm serving food that I think is good and I think you'll like, and I've worked really hard to prepare something. But I'm actually not that concerned that you as an individual love this meal. To me, what's more important is the collective experience we're having around the table versus any one person's satisfaction with what they're eating. Like, oh, this is the thing I was craving. Or, but that's how we can live, right? Like, oh, I feel like pizza today. I'm going to go to pizza tonight. I mean, that's how we operate. And not just with food, but other things too. And I think unwiring that is difficult. I mean, as Labrie workers, we see it because we're sitting on the other side of it, but it's made me much more conscious. I'll eat anything that anybody puts in front of me. It's just made me much more conscious, but I think there is this level of awareness first, and that's a hard thing to point out in a tactful way.
Over the last year, actually, it's been a little better, but there was this era, wasn't there? I'm trying to think, Sue. An era where a large percentage of every group of students that came had some kind of weird food issue, or something they wouldn't eat, or some sort of weird diet they were on. Now, a few of them had real allergies, you know, had allergies and sensitivities that would make them sick. But a lot of them, it was not the case. It was really about preferences or some experimental diet they were trying or something. And so part of what, you know, we talk a lot here and try to teach and model about community means taking part in what's here, and it means being open to try new things. Certainly, if you go to another culture, you've got to be, unless you're going to offend everybody, you better be open to trying the foods that are put in front of you, and to be grateful. And so that's one of the lessons we try to learn, is help people try things they haven't tried before. And some kids grow up and are completely, I think their parents do them no favor letting them just eat whatever they want, you know. Pizza and pasta. We did have one guy here, all he ate was pizza, pasta, and hamburgers. That was all he ate. And so he missed a lot of meal. We realized, you know, we couldn't cater to him. And it wasn't helpful for him. So, you know, you hope you get encourage people to try little bits. I have actually, I used to, when I was living here, if I had made a dessert, you know, and I'd made a nice meal and somebody was cooking, I'd say, I would just treat the students like I had my kids. I said, you have to eat a little bit or you don't get dessert. And I didn't say that. And actually, yeah, I did that often. Maybe the reparenting thing. Yeah.
So, Marty, I'm probably taking this in a little different direction.
That's fine.
But we've had some interesting conversations in our church. Someone talked about the changing times. And you know, the stranger in the loving of strangers, I think some people would see almost a more extreme estrangement between the church and the culture today than ever before, and a very interesting direction. And we're exploring what it means to deal with that in our church gatherings. And we're talking about things like, what does it mean to welcome the stranger into our church gatherings? And different things like acknowledging their presence, expressing honor for them to be there, explaining ourselves and explaining what we're doing and so forth. And I was interested to know, do you think that would fit under hospitality, or does that park someplace else, or how does that all work into the whole equation? It isn't about, you know, there's no meals and gifting in that regard, but would it be a part of that, or is that somewhere else?
Well, I don't know. What do people think? I think in a broad sense, I mean, you know, the church, our aim should be to be salt and light in the world, and certainly to welcome strangers, to welcome non-believers into, you know, we want non-believers to come to church and to figure out what makes them feel welcome, what doesn't, what are stumbling blocks to having to church members feeling they can bring their non-Christian friends and have them feel welcome and want to come back. I don't see it as disconnected from hospitality. You know, hospitality is practiced in different settings, but welcoming, being welcoming to strangers or to those who don't share your faith. Yeah, what does anybody think? I mean, that's a great conversation to be having in a church, because all too often, I think there's just such a separation, or a lot of Christians who go to church just wouldn't dare bring their non-Christian friends along. And it's really good to have discussions within the church. Well, why not? You know, how can this church? What can we do in the worship services and maybe in other kinds of meetings that would make non-Christians want to be there and help the Christians want to bring their friends. Yeah, you want to say something, Sarah?
Yeah, okay. I think it falls in the realm of to be hospitable.
Yeah.
If it's going to be more than a to-do list of, you know, if I do all these things, then I am being hospitable.
Right.
It's about shaping a quality of character in yourself, like to become a hospitable person, right. And that involves your disposition, it involves attitudes, how you see people or don't, and I think that, so then to take that beyond the shaping of an individual character, it's about shaping the character of a community of people and about a church culture even.
Right.
So I think it's very, very related to the topic.
Yeah, and very important. Yeah.
I thought about, what I call it, walking by the Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
That a person, when you run the meeting, you're responsible to God for that meeting and for those people who give you the time and attention. And think about Jesus Christ ministering healing to six different blind people.
Mm-hmm.
And he did it differently every time. It wasn't a formula.
Mm-hmm.
And like, for instance, coming here tonight,
mm-hmm.
you know, sometimes, like, I go to Toastmasters, I go to different kinds of meetings, and you stand up and say, I'm Robert Olivier from Fitchburg, and I do this and that, and you kind of know who I am. I come here tonight, we don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And you can offend someone or welcome someone with the same action,
mm-hmm.
but I believe that the prayer in preparation for a meeting. And Jesus Christ constantly did this. He would be up on a mountaintop mm-hmm. by himself before he appointed the 12
right.
apostles. Before he did other difficult mm-hmm. things in his ministry, he would be up all night in prayer.
Mm-hmm.
And I have never done that, but I can see the need for it.
Yeah, yeah.
And a healing service mm-hmm. can be done in a number of different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to believe that we can prepare ourselves to be in the right position to say the right words and to handle the formalities in the right way, that the people are going to feel welcome and are going to be open to the
mm-hmm.
Spirit of God and receive what God wants them to have mm-hmm. through our agency.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's very helpful. Yeah, did you want to come back on that?
I was just going to say that one of the things that we wrestle with is that we're not starting from a neutral position. I mean, we've had to face the fact that we function as a closed club in many ways. We have extremely specialized language. We have extremely shorthand terminology. We have a lot of cultural assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
And so it isn't a matter of, you know, how do I make choices from a neutral ground sort of thing. It's
mm-hmm.
like, if we're serious about this, it's like, oh, Holy Spirit, deliver us from this. Because
mm-hmm.
we have no idea even what we don't know about what we don't know about what we don't know about being hospitable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Dick, you want to say something?
Yeah, just on that line, the thing that strikes me about this is that I think many times groups of Christians do not know how they are perceived.
That's right. That's right.
And really don't like it if they hear. The spirit of what I would have been calling a tribal spirit, where you don't, it doesn't matter how you're perceived, you're doing it right. And you're right and they're wrong. And that can be a huge gap there. And
right.
increase the sensitivity but how we're perceived, which doesn't mean we need to abandon the things we believe to be true, but does mean we really may need to think through language. Yes.
Language is a big thing.
I think people learn a tribal Christian dialect, and that doesn't...
It's really off-putting.
That really is not doing what we want it to do.
Yeah. Yeah, John Stott, who many of you probably read some of his works. He was a minister in the Church of England in London for many years. And he used to challenge people to think of different language, different ways of describing the gospel, of describing what it is we believe, and just to try to do it differently. Really rack your brain to be creative in the way we describe what we believe, because it is so... The sort of Jesus died for your sins is so predictable in our culture now, and people have heard it, they've been evangelized, and they're so turned off by the predictability of Christian jargon. And so the challenge to really pray to the Holy Spirit to help us think of fresh ways of saying things and of language, and again to be open to look in the mirror and see how we are perceived and realize, whoa, that really puts people off. You know, we make it too easy to be pigeonholed, to be stereotyped. And the media doesn't help, because the media loves to tell stories about idiot Christians doing idiot things and being hypocrites and, you know, all with the lingo. So, you know, Josh.
No, I'm just going to take it. I think for churches to explain why they're doing what they're doing, or what they're doing throughout the service, why are we singing these songs?
Yeah.
What is this book that we're talking about? I think that's helpful both for people who maybe don't identify as Christians but are in the church, as well as people who are just regularly in the church. Because I think of it like, if I grew up only ever watching basketball and then I was brought to a hockey game, I wouldn't want them to stop playing hockey because I don't know the rules, and then they play basketball instead. Like, I'd like someone to explain to me how hockey works, so I understand what's going on here, and then I can decide, oh, basketball is infinitely superior to this sport. I think there's something about explaining it that it's good both for people within the church to be like, oh, right, this is why we do communion, or this is what communion is supposed to be, or this is what a sermon is, or this is why we sing, and this is why we pass the peace to one another. Our church has a little margin in the bulletin that just actually has a short explanation on what these things are. And as someone who goes to the church most weeks, I'm like, oh, right, okay, this is why we do this. And, so I think being able to explain why we do the things we do, especially in church, is helpful, because they're easily misunderstood or becoming so familiar with them that we lose what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, Nikki.
I saw a bunch of your a few years ago that said good apologetics starts with good coffee. That idea of goodness, of like desiring good things with giving people good things to eat. And, you know, Mr. Shaker, when people would say, this is such a good meal, she would say, well, it's meant to be. that are meant to be good, and the church should be offering not just good food, but the picture of goodness, and to shape our desires towards goodness. Mm-hmm. I mean, good coffee is just sort of, you know, a little... to welcome them, not all. I mean, churches are notorious for having bad coffee, you know?
And styrofoam cups.
You know? To be able to give people a picture of good things, that Christianity offers good things, not just good food, but a richness of the shape or desire instead of just, like, humdrum, you know? I don't know who that person was, especially in New England, who was on the bummer too, but very well, just that starts with coffee. But, you know, that idea of goodness.
Yeah.
What are we doing in churches to shape desire towards goodness?
And I would add to that, because I think it's beauty.
Yeah.
Goodness and beauty. Yeah. And that's very much, that was a big reality for the Shapers. And it really is in all the branches of the Rue. is that God is the source of all beauty. God cares about beauty. Human beings thrive much better with beauty. And I'm not going to try to define beauty, get into a discussion of aesthetics and so on, but God's creation is beautiful. And it's a wonderful story. Mr. Schaefer, who I haven't remembered the story, but Dick reminded me of it recently, is that she was visiting some missionaries, I think in Africa, wasn't it, Dick? She had a very short time to be there. And she was visiting them, and she went into their home and looked around and saw nothing beautiful, just ugliness. And thought, well, I'm here for a really short time. The most important thing I can do is bring some beauty into this home. And she went out and just collected things, things that didn't cost money. She went outside and collected some twigs and stones and she brought whatever was there, flower, and brought them in to beautify the person's home, hoping to teach something to this missionary that actually beauty matters. You know, you can get up and preach the Bible to these folks, but there's got to be beauty. And it's one of the things that's been important in LaBrie from the beginning, is that the food is good and it's attractive, and we make, you know, things don't have to be expensive to care for beauty. Put a tablecloth on, to put a candle on. Candles aren't that expensive. Do something, you know, to show your concern for beauty, and it makes a huge difference. Dick and I were invited to some people. We didn't know them well, but they invited a family, big family, lived somewhere in Boston. We were invited there for a meal, and we both came away afterwards with exactly the same sense of sort of dearth. We both came away and said, there was no attention to beauty in that home. Nothing. It was really, it was so striking. And I don't know. I don't know if other people experienced that same thing, but... Yeah,
I just wanted to mention, I just found point 9 very helpful, and I think a lot of people would find that helpful, you know, the need for setting limits.
Mm-hmm.
And something else you said, taking responsibility for the atmosphere of our homes.
Yeah.
And it's to me, what that is saying is that you have a, there's a predictability that you are, you know, that you yourself are coming from.
Yeah.
Offering what can be a very unpredictable, you know, opening yourself up to unpredictability, that you have a base, a foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if people understood that more or thought through that more, okay, what is the, you know, the atmosphere, you know, what is it that I'm, you know, that I'm having as a fundamental base of what I'm doing, you know, it maybe help them to open themselves up more to the unpredictability that comes when you welcome different people, and continue to fall back on that.
Yeah, it's actually really important. And I remember when we were in London for 9 years, eight years, in a big old house that belonged to LaBrie, and a church met in the house. So our address was in Mr. Schaefer's book, LaBrie. So people were coming wandering through, you know, who had read LaBrie or on their way to Kathmandu but wanted to stop at LaBrie on their way. It was the early 70s, and that was happening. But there was also a church that met in our home, and it was our family home. And the Macaulays, actually, Schaefer's daughter, Susan Macaulay, and her husband, Ranald, who had been in that house before us, were really adamant. Well, we were this young couple with one baby, and, you know, while we were there, we had two more kids. They were just really adamant at the need to, said, you have a lot going on here, and you're going to have people coming through, and they're going to want to stay here. They're going to want to stay all over your floors, because our address was in Mrs. Schaefer's book, LaBrie. And she said, you've got to be able to say no. You've got to be able to protect the ministry that you have. And that was incredibly helpful. We found it very hard because people did come. I remember a whole group of people showed up who hitchhiked from France, I think, showed up on our doorstep and just expected, because they'd read Mr. Schaefer's book, LaBrie, that they could sleep all over our floors. And we had little, I don't know how many kids I had by then, but little kids, we were exhausted. We had a church that met in our house. We had to organize the whole house for church on Sunday mornings. And by that time, we had said yes so many times to people and ended up resenting it because we were basically had given up making the atmosphere in our home. She said that we ended up coming to the decision. Well, when this happens, we're going to find out ahead of time where there are some bed and breakfasts, and we will, as part of a tithe, give some money. If somebody comes and they need a place to stay and we can't have them, we will give them some money to say there's a bed and breakfast down here where you can stay. Because most of the time we had people living with us who we had invited to stay who were basically wanting part of the community but needing a place temporarily, a single mom and her daughter looking for work and a place to stay. And so we already had that going on, and we couldn't just have chaos. We also found we needed structure, like with little kids, and with lots of, and we had some very crazy people in our church who were really crazy, and a huge diversity. Lady Catherwood used to come, and then there were these ex-cons, and then there were doctors and lawyers and teachers, and then some people who were really, really not balanced at all. And they would often show up and want Dick's attention. And so, you know, we developed a pattern when our kids were young that at 4:30 in the afternoon or sometime like that, when I had to make dinner, that was Dick's time with the kids. And he would take them to the park or take them out to the shed where they were boys. They always wanted to make toy guns. Or not always, but Dick would have time with them. And we found it was actually important to the people who came to the door that they saw that we had the structure and the schedule, and we weren't going to throw it up in the air every day. The children needed it, and the children are the first, you know. There, your hospitality has to start with your immediate family and go out from there. And as you see needs of your children, you know, things may be going fine, and then you notice something is not working with this child, and maybe, you know, you have to regroup and rethink. You know, do we have too many strangers in, or do we have to protect certain times of the day, or, you know, your kids, you have to really protect your kids that way. So that was. But it was a really wonderful lesson when this guy, Cully, came the second time. The first time when, again, we felt resentful. And we said, how can that be pleasing to God, to open our home and feel resentful? That can't be right. There's got to be a way that we can open our home and form, have a structure, have it so it works for us, and so that we're making the atmosphere, and then we don't feel resentful. And we may have to tell someone to leave if they're not respecting, you know, what we've given them. Anyway, yeah.
Sorry, I just keep going down the practicality trail there. We've kind of had a dream for a long time to just be hospitable all the time.
Yeah.
Have people in our home, and we would love to invite people to stay with us or speak out, you know, those who need a place to stay. And one of my big hang-ups is that we have two small children.
Okay.
And the idea of making them vulnerable to total strangers just makes me freak out. And I was just wondering if you could share, you know, expound upon some of those practical ways that you, like, I mean, I'm just getting real, you know, down to the details with you. I'm thinking of, like, at night when my kids are asleep in the same house and I'm asleep and the guest is, who knows?
Yeah.
How do you handle that?
Well, I think that's where the kind of things that I think Christine quotes Martin Luther talking about people having references, not taking a total stranger off the street into a small private home with, you know, but having, knowing something about a person before you would have them come and actually stay in your house in a situation like that. Christine talking about the need for these sort of threshold places between public and private so people can get to know each other, so people can be recommended. And I guess in the early church that there was a lot of that. People, we read it in Paul's letters. He sends people, Timothy, I'm sending Timothy to you. He is a good and faithful, blah, 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 you know, put him up. Or Phoebe, she is one of the leaders here in the church, and I'm sending her. She's bringing gifts, or people who were sent to give gifts. There was recommendations so that people knew something about them, and that was true of the families that offered over the years to take people in who had been students here for a while, but needed a place to stay. But they were still figuring out what was next in their life and needed a place to stay. These families got to know them while they were still here, and we could recommend them or tell them, well, you know, we could recommend them or say, recommend them, but also say, but these are needs this person has. This is, you should be aware of this. You know, this is a potential issue that you might have. So, I wouldn't just go. You do have to be wise, and you have to protect your kids. And so I wouldn't just go and I wouldn't go down to Boston Common and grab someone, and say, come on home, we've got a spare bedroom, you know. But, yes, too.
I also think that we shouldn't be, we shouldn't feel bad about just saying, at this point in my life, I can't do that.
That's right.
Because I work here at the Brief, have worked in the Brief for a long time, and it took me a little while to realize, I am my children's advocate. My husband and I, we are our children's advocate. Their first advocate, and we are responsible. And that's, sometimes you just have to say no. For me, I found it hard sometimes if some students wanted to babysit our children, and I just, like, something in me just, it wasn't right. Didn't sit with that. We usually ended up having what we call helpers, our interns, like interns who, or volunteers who've been here for several months and we know them. So we would sometimes ask them to babysit, but not people I felt uncomfortable with, and I realized my children are not part of the ministry to them.
Yeah.
So even though I don't have to let them babysit my children because it's good for them.
No.
You can't think like that.
No, exactly. And I remember Susan McCoy.
She's free to say, I can't do that now.
Yeah.
Some of that, let's say, will depend on, to some degree, on the design of your house or your bedroom.
That's right.
That's right. Very, very concrete and practical.
Right.
Sometimes, again, I remember having a guy call, well, he didn't call, police call. You expect such and such a person coming. And I said, no, we don't expect him. He has just pulled a knife on a gas station attendant somewhere in Connecticut. Uh-huh. But he's coming to you and with all sorts of bombs and down debris, And I said, well, you know, if he's there, tell him no. We don't really expect him, and we're not really, he's not actually welcome to give him the thing. Of course, an hour later, he shows
up. With him.
I just have to say, okay, we'll let you exhaust it, and we'll let you have a good solid nap for 3 hours this afternoon, but then I'm going to take you to the train. And he laid it on me, tons of
guilt.
What's the matter? I thought you were Christians. But how can you, you know, when you're responsible for a whole slew of other people in the house, how can you possibly have someone in with that going for him with no sort of sense of that happened to him some years ago or he's gone through something on the other side? But I think it's very hard. I felt awful.
Yes.
He was very good at laying the guilt on him. But I mean,
his responsibility.
How does he let go if he pulled his knife on a gas station attendant?
Well, I'm not sure. That's another problem I have. There was a difference of opinion over what the knife meant.
Oh dear. Yeah,
I was just going to say too that even at LaBrie, I mean, one of the things Marty talked about, that one of the benefits of LaBrie is that we are several units together.
That's right.
But even here, when people come to LaBrie to stay with us, they're theoretically meant to send us an email and we ask for certain information and why they want to come and things like that. We don't do background checks. We don't do core checks. I mean, we pray for God to send us the people of his choosing, and we pray that he would keep people away who would in some way be a harm to the community, especially with the group. We pray for that. But we also, in general, don't, if people do just show up unannounced or they appear, we don't let them stay. I remember a time when I was first worker, the students have Thursdays off, and the bigger the students went into Boston for the day, and I went and picked them up at the train station, and there was one more person than I had taken. And one of the girls was like, oh, this is my friend John. I met up with him in the city. Is it okay if he comes back to the hospital at 7 o'clock? I said, sure. So he came back. And then about an hour later, she came and knocked on my apartment door. And she's like, and his sister lives in Worcester. She could come pick him up. But just be easier if he could crash here tonight. We're going to, it turns out he was someone that she had met at a, music concert the summer before. And he just saw on Facebook, he lives in Worcester, he saw on Facebook that she was in Southboro, and they met up. So she didn't even know him that well. And there weren't small children living in this house at the time even, but it was one of those things where I madly called Ben, and I was like, what do I do? But I said no, because even, there weren't children here, but even, we have no idea who this guy is. And so even at LaBrie, even when we have, there's a lot of people here, there's a lot of eyes, even space-wise, we don't have a guarantee that anybody is who they say they are, but we also generally don't let people come stay here who we have no context for, who we have no, and so he's amazingly his sister was able to come pick him up. They hung out for a couple hours and he left by midnight.
Yeah, but also because of what we are is a residential study center, and we don't want people to come and just stay here because they're tourists who want to check out Boston, and this is a cheaper place to stay than in Boston or somewhere else. So we often say, that's not what we're here for, and that really distracts. If there's somebody there doing that, that distracts from the students, what the students are doing in the whole work and study program. We had one other situation where the Southboro police called us. Actually, we have a really good relationship with the police and with the Board of Selectmen and so on. But someone called and said, we have this girl. She's the girlfriend of a guy who held up a gas station. This is a different person.
He left without paying.
That's right. He took off, left without paying, but he must have left the girl too. They caught. All right, the police caught him for driving away without paying for gas, and he was in custody, but the girl hadn't done anything, and they didn't want to have to hire somebody to just either put her in prison because she hadn't done anything bad, or she was just a passenger, or pay for a matron to sort of look after her. So they asked if she could come here. And we let her come. She wasn't dangerous. We prayed for her. She ended up getting snowed in for 3 days. We had a blizzard. We were right in the middle of a blizzard, and she couldn't leave. And in fact, it was over a weekend. We had a church service here, so she was part of this church service because we couldn't get to church because it really was a big blizzard. So we usually go to local churches, so we just prayed for her and prayed that she would get something out of her time here. A few days later, she was sort of didn't want to go home. I think she was from Kentucky or something. Parent didn't really want to see her parents, but we didn't really know anything about her. But
Thing happened at Korean LaBrie with a group of German businessmen. No way. Yeah, great. In the summer, at the time of Korean LaBrie, a very odd circumstances, and it was a very, very bad blizzard. And Kim Hyung, who leads the work at Korean LaBrie, said, "I just went for it."
Preach to them.
Yeah,
we have a captive audience.
Yeah, it's really expected.
Yeah, Melissa.
This is one more comment to your question. I think LaBrie is a community of families and single workers, so people, and I think there are probably different principles that might apply to that as to be a family unit who offers hospitality. And I think in that way we can actually take more risk, more risky people, because more people are watching and observing and seeing that throughout the day and how they interact with different people. So I think you can't just apply I'm going to open my home without those limitations. I think you could, team up with other people in your neighborhood or community and, offer something where more people are involved in that.
Yeah.
But otherwise, I think it's wise to be, thoughtful and mindful of your children and what is risky and what's not. So, you probably need to take less risk in that sense because there's not many of you.
Right. Yeah, and we actually found it more difficult when we were living in London with a church meeting in our house. We were the only ones workers living in the house. Occasionally, we had another worker. And there was a church community that came and went from our house, and again, some very mixed group of people. But and we almost always had somebody staying. As I said, it was somebody who was looking for work, somebody who, we got to know them, they were staying. But we found that more difficult than being in a residential branch where we could share the work with other people, where we could have days off, where you can close your door because the other workers are on, and you can put a sign on your door, do not disturb, cause day off, or whatever. We found that really hard because we had little children, and I still remember, I still feel guilty for this. How many? 40 years ago? I don't know, but is that it was a Thursday, it was our day off, we were trying at least to go out and walk in the country. We were trying to get out, we had to, you know, the kids were little, we put them in backpacks and front packs and take them out to walk in the country. And we had almost no time together for a while. It was crazy. And the doorbell rang. And I just didn't want to see. I wanted to get in the car and get out to the country and have our walk and go to our pub lunch and our cream tea and, you know, things you do in England. And I remember peering out our bedroom window to see who was at the door. I wish I hadn't, because it was this sort of middle-aged to elderly lady. I didn't know who she was. I had no idea who she was. But I just couldn't go to the door and answer the door and I sort of duck out the back, you know, get in the car and take off for the country. But it was harder in some ways because we were the only ones living in the house. And also it was hard because we almost always had someone living there with us, and we wanted, you know, we felt the need for some meals by ourselves, some family meals, which again you can do when you're sharing the work with several other families. You're not on for every meal. On, you know, the Morales don't serve every meal. Or Mary Frances, we share the meals out, and so families have meals by themselves. And so here we when we had somebody living with us, it was just us and them. There was only one kitchen, one dining room. And I remember trying for a while. It never worked very well. We'd feel awkward saying to the people who were staying with us, well, we need some time by ourselves, so here's a tray, go to your room. You know, so we tried taking a tray with our toddlers up to our bedroom, and I still remember one of them just, you know, sitting on the floor with a tray and the child walking through the sand with the peanut butter sandwiches, and, you know, around. It was more difficult. I was amazed how much easier it was once we moved to a residential branch where we had other families and we could spell each other and we could, you know, take turns. Yeah.
Maybe I'll address this tomorrow, but did you find there were things that made guests hospitable? That guests became more host-like?
That's a very good question.
You know, do we by turns do
that? This may not be... We definitely have found over the years that guests who've been here often really learn and become attracted to the idea of being hospitable themselves. And so, will, you know, determine. I mean, there are some people who are so unused to sitting down at a table for a meal and having conversation. We've had some students who really, literally get up and stand at the back of their chair and move like that because they're just so nervous and antsy by a meal that may go on for an hour with people talking. But some of those, I can think of, said after being here for a while, said, you know, that was really important, and that's I'm going to have sit down meals when I get home, or I'm going to, you know, institute this, or, and others there was someone who was a grad school, and after being here went and just started having meals in her. She's a student, but having sort of discussions and meals and inviting people for making chili and inviting friends to come for some discussion and things in her place. So the hospitality, getting a vision for hospitality and for having sit-down meals, that kind of thing, definitely happens to a lot of people who, you know, after they've been here. But are you talking about just while they're here?
I would like to imagine that somebody would have said to you, you need some time to yourself for your family.
Yeah.
Let us take care of it.
Some people do, actually. And some people definitely, we talk about, you have this phrase, a sense of other. that some people have much more sense of other than other people. Some people have a very strong sense of themselves and very little sense of other. And it's one of the things we pray will grow in the students and helpers' lives who come. I mean, some of them come already with a very profound sense of other, and they care about you, and they're concerned for you, and they're concerned that you have a good day off, and they're concerned if you're sick, and they want to help you out. So that, definitely. But, and other people grow in that, which is why, and we sometimes see it right, you know, see it before our eyes, which is wonderful. But it's also something we pray for, a growth in a sense of other with each other, because the students themselves come from very different backgrounds and may have very different questions from each other or very different reasons why they came, may are put together in a, you know, this house does not have individual dorm rooms. This was a rich person's mansion, and there was, you know, the aunt's bedroom up here, and there was someone else's bedroom over here. So there's a boy's dorm and there's a girl's dorm. There's basically, you're sharing a room with a lot of people you wouldn't necessarily have chosen to be your roommate. And that sense of other, which is something we talk about and we pray that the students will start to listen to, you know, hear each other, maybe someone that they're not very patient with initially or just can't relate to, will start to be more hospitable. And that often happens. It's sometimes one of the most important things that does happen in someone's life here, more important than all the lectures they listen to. Yeah. Yeah.
I've been thinking about how many times it talks about one another in the church epistles. Well, in the Gospels too.
Yep.
But it's just that concept of learn to love one another, be kind one to another.
Yep.
So many places. I mean, and I thought about that in terms of hospitality, that it's all about one another. And it's just a way, a lifestyle to live. And I also thought about the word communion, which I think comes from
Koinonia,
one sharing. So you learn, and it start out that way, but you learn to fully share with others. And that's all hospitality, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Okay.
And it's not something that comes natural to type things.
Mm-mm.
It's something we have to work at.
Yeah, definitely. And that can grow. Yeah. But again, also that in different seasons of our lives, we're able to do more in different things. Yeah, but you're right. Yeah.
It has always struck me very soundly that the only ritual Jesus actually instituted was the communal meal.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, this is how you remember me, is at the communal meal. Mm-hmm. This is the only ritual he passed to us besides the Lord's Prayer.
Mm-hmm.
And it is the heart. I mean, if that's the only one that God, that he managed to pass on, and it's the heart of our faith, and it's how we show God's love. It's not something that's added on. It's essential to what we do.
I think baptism, I think you could consider baptism, too. Because he didn't do baptism.
That was John, technically. Yeah, baptism.
Now, baptism, baptized in the name of the Father and the Son.
Yeah, he did say that. But... The more I look at culture and the sort of culture of domination and exploitation that we have worldwide and the counterculture that we have of charity and love, is this ability of the other, of empathy, is something that evil is trying to destroy. And it's just, it's so fascinating that you're right, it is about loving each other and caring for each other, you can feel what they're feeling. And that's what God wants us to be good at.
And it's very interesting because the barriers that Paul was concerned to break down in the early church, Jew, Gentile, male, female, slave, free, these were massive barriers in the culture.
Yes.
And there Christians were actually called by some pagans, some first century pagans were actually described as the third race because they broke down those barriers which were not, they didn't make sense, they couldn't be explained by the first century sociologists because they broke down the barriers between, not easily, you read the letters, it wasn't easy, and Paul was, you know, Paul had to correct Peter for refusing to eat with Gentiles, and But the fact that that was, the church was, the whole model of the church was meant to be cross-cultural and break down these barriers was very radical in the first century and really did communicate some of the gospel and the power of the gospel and the oneness of all people in Christ. Yeah. That's it. Okay. Thank you very much. Come back tomorrow. What time do we start again? What time do we start?
9.
9. Thank you.